this is not going to be a glancing blow. This is not going to be a tropical storm. This is not going to be, one of those storms that hit and move out to sea. This is going to be a Mike Tyson punch to the Carolina coast.
Hurricane Florence is knocking on North Carolina's door, powered by dangerous winds of more than 100 miles per hour. The storm was downgraded from a Category 4 to a Category 3 on Wednesday and then down again to a Category 2 overnight. But Florence is still expected to cause catastrophic flooding and deadly conditions, and it's expected to make landfall later tonight or early Friday. In preparation for the worst, many across the Carolinas and Virginia are packing up and leaving. But for some, evacuating homes and cities is virtually impossible.
We tell them you should go. They can hear that message. They can rationally understand the need to leave. But if they don't have a vehicle and they use public transportation, or they don't have a vehicle that is dependable enough to travel the distances they need to travel, or they don't have enough money to put fuel in the tank, those are some very real considerations.
So what happens to the most vulnerable people when the storm hits? I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. That's where we start the show today. It's not just people living in poverty, or even those who can't afford to evacuate their homes. It can also mean those living with chronic illness or disabilities.
In the past, we've seen many, many problems with hospitals and nursing homes after storms.
Sherry Fink is a correspondent at the New York Times and has reported extensively on how hurricanes can ravage healthcare facilities. She wrote a book about what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina called 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital.
Hurricane Katrina is sort of the touch point. In that case, Memorial Medical Center, for example, which I ended up writing a book about, got so desperate. It was surrounded by water, like many American hospitals that are in flood zones. Its electrical systems were not protected against flooding. And so they were in danger of losing all power. They had to decide which patients to put on helicopters first. And then they did lose all power, and things became so desperate that later, a doctor and two nurses were arrested and accused of having killed their patients. They were not indicted, but in fact, some of the hospital staff who I interviewed talked about giving patients medicines like morphine and fast-acting sedatives to try to hasten their deaths because they felt that the situation was so desperate. So that's a very extreme example, but we've seen much more recently terrible problems in healthcare institutions. I mean, in Hurricane Sandy in New York City, where there were many hospitals and nursing homes that had to be evacuated because they stayed in place as the storm came and then they lost power, to last year in Hurricane Irma in Florida, where in one single nursing home that was just without power for a prolonged period, a dozen patients died from the heat.
And Sherry says we have to keep learning from past storms.
This poses a really difficult problem for healthcare institutions. If they're not prepared, if they don't have systems like generators and electrical systems up high, if they don't have their own sources of water, they can get into quite a desperate situation. On the other hand, and you saw playing out the last few days, this whole decision about whether you evacuate a healthcare institution ahead of a storm is also a tricky one because that involves a lot of risk for patients. It is, of course, expensive for the healthcare institutions themselves. And we never know exactly where the storm is going to hit.
Sherry Fink of the New York Times. She's currently in the South Atlantic reporting on Florence. But hospitals are only one piece of making sure no one gets left behind. Mark Burtis is a former director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for Shelby County, Ohio, and now an emergency management consultant. And he spends a lot of time thinking about how cities and states do and should help disadvantaged people escape harm's way. Burtis says we need to be thinking a lot more about the inclusiveness of emergency planning.
When you get a team together to write an emergency plan, you look around the room and you assume everyone has the exact same capabilities as you. And then you write a plan for what you know most, your own conditions. So if someone told you you need to evacuate, you would think, okay, well, I have this vehicle or I have this larger vehicle. I can fit more of my pictures, more of my photos, more of the things that I want to save. And we'll get in a car and we'll drive somewhere. But that's not the case for a large portion of Americans. And I would say in the past couple years is where we've really in the emergency management community started trying to change the way that we plan.
Right. And I think and then there's the different populations that we're looking at outside of accessibility to transportation, which is obviously a critical part of being able to evacuate. There are those who just cannot leave. And I'm thinking specifically of those who are in hospitals, medical facilities, and even in prisons, which has been a major concern, I think, particularly when it comes to South Carolina. Do you have any thoughts on those specific groups?
So one of the problems with planning for those specific groups is that, especially with a storm this large, this storm, the path is wobbling. So it looks like it's going to hit North Carolina on the South Carolina border, but then stall. So we have finite resources in this country for evacuation. If we need to evacuate someone from a long-term care facility or a hospital who's medically vulnerable, it's just dangerous to even consider moving some people who are on long-term medical devices and attached to the need for power or clean water for dialysis. And the thought of moving them, just that transportation alone, increases their risk of something bad happening. So we have specialized units that can move those, but we don't have enough to evacuate 2 states worth of hospitals of those medically fragile people, even if we confine it to the coastlines. The prisoners, incarcerated individuals, they are at risk. And I do know that some of the prisons are evacuating, but sometimes they restrict those. The Department of Corrections will do the review and say, this portion of the prison is strong enough, we're just going to evacuate this portion. But, I mean, we're at capacity at many prisons in this country. And so then now we're going to create an overcrowding condition at a different prison. And the concerns that planners like myself were talking about with prison officials, Department of Corrections officials, is the if we move them there, now the power companies just told us that we may lose power for up to a couple weeks in areas. Are we overcrowding a prison now, and now we have the potential for a long-term power outage? Are we making those conditions worse? And so it's really a fundamental wicked problem that has a lot of variables that are discussed. And we do a poor job of funding emergency preparedness in this country.
What do you think is driving that, though, Mark? There's been a lot of talk today, and we'll be talking about this in our next segment, about some money that's being diverted to ICE away from FEMA, for example. So there are lots of, conversations happening about those dollars. But at the broader level, what do you think is driving the lack of preparedness? We are now in, we've had Katrina, we've had Sandy, we've had, hurricanes are not a surprise to us anymore. Why are we still struggling?
Part of the problem, I believe, is that if you're not directly impacted by it, it's the drama that you see on TV. It looks bad, but then the news cycle changes focus. And there's so much occurring in the news it doesn't impact people that I know. And when we talk about, like, did you see what happened in Puerto Rico? I can tell you that some people that I have acquaintances with are like, I didn't realize it was that bad, unless it impacts you. And then the cameras move on and we forget that those people are still rebuilding.
So we mentioned being able to evacuate, and I'm wondering if there are moments where particularly low-income Americans, those who other vulnerable populations like people who don't speak English, for example, you mentioned hourly workers. What are the specific things that could impact these populations in terms of trying to evacuate during a storm?
So one of the first things that we have to realize is our populations are diverse. And so I know in Franklin County, Ohio, they do a good job of putting out all of their preparedness information and the response information in real time in Somali, which sounds weird for the Midwest and in middle of Ohio, but they have realized that they have a large Somali population. And so they work with that Somali community to make sure that what they're saying in English gets translated into a meaningful message in Somali. It's not as easy as going out to Google and just having the Google Translate. The meaning has to be received appropriately and realizing who's in our community. For far too long, we had people sitting at a desk planning for people who look like them and who had the capabilities and the resources that they have. Once we adopted a whole community mindset, we need to be bringing those other partners, and we have groups. So if we can't bring impoverished people to the table to plan for us, we have stakeholders in the community and community people working on their behalf in groups that are looking out for individual pockets of they're on the edge when it comes to a response. They day to day, they live on a financial edge that some of us can't imagine. And then we tell them you should evacuate. And if they go to Expedia and look and, well, every hotel in Charlotte, which seems to be a safe distance away from the coast, is at least $100. then it's going to take $60 in gas if I can even get the gas in the car, assuming that my car is running well enough. And then now will they take my pets? And that's an additional expense sometimes. And we're asking them to do stuff that they have no financial means to do. A couple years ago, the Federal Reserve put out that study that said 47% of Americans can't come up with $400 if they need it. Well, I think a weekend away at a hotel or at a shelter, even to get somewhere else, is quickly going to run up over $400.
Mark, give us a sense of what can be done. I mean, we're having this conversation, you know, as I'm watching Florence on the news sort of, you know, make its way towards the mainland United States here, towards the Carolinas. There are about three storms behind Florence that could be tropical storms. We don't know yet. What can be done in the short term to help folks who do need to evacuate or these vulnerable populations?
So in the short term, it is really tough 3 days to affect an evacuation if you haven't done much planning for it. And having deals and memorandums of agreement already in place with the Amtraks and the local metro busing systems and school buses, the problem with those are, again, that you're going to have an acknowledgement by those bus drivers that they're going to stay behind, that they become essential emergency workers in a hurricane. And that may not be a job that routinely sees that. We will have a lot of first responders staying in station houses. We will have a lot of ambulance drivers staying in their stations. And it's these people are voluntarily staying behind in the aftermath just so that they're available as soon as possible.
Mark Burtis is a former director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for Shelby County, Ohio, and currently an emergency management consultant. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So how are you preparing for Hurricane Florence?
This is Jody. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I volunteer with the Red Cross. I'm in Wilmington making sure there are nurses caring for the people who have evacuated to the shelters all along the coast in North Carolina.
This is Mary Claire from Goose Creek, South Carolina. This is not our first rodeo. We are well prepared and have everything we need. God bless everybody in the path of the storm. I wish us all safety.
Hi, my name is Denise, and I'm with Dots Place Animal Haven in Seneca, South Carolina. Right now, we're working to get some of the municipal shelters on the coast, get the animals out of there, because many of those are in low-lying and flooding areas. So we're bringing all of our rescue dogs into our home.
Hi, this is Orin from Atlanta, Georgia. My parents live in Myrtle Beach. They're evacuating to come stay with me in my studio apartment for a whole week. Yay, hurricane.
And thanks for sharing your Hurricane Florence preparation plans and helping others in your communities as well. Keep your stories coming our way at 877-8MYTAKE, and please stay safe.